From the shadow of Rockford Tower, behind enemy lines, in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast. This is your Highlands Bunker podcast. Comrades and friends, hello. Rob here. this evening, we're going to have to do some formal stuff, so I hope you'll stick with us right now. We need to make sure we have a quorum. So let's begin this clandestine meeting of the Corporate Law Advisory Board of the Highlands Bunker Podcast, LLC, doing business as Corporate Law Advisors Signal Chat, LLC. Senior Legal Correspondent, William C. Martin, Esquire. Bill, hello.
Now, therefore, good evening.
You have to say that in those... Actually, you have to say exactly that or it doesn't count. Thank you. Thank you for checking the bylaws first. The contributing editor of the Delaware Call and the Raoul Duke Doctor of Journalism, Jordan Howe. Jordan.
Howdy.
And the editor of Chancery Daily and the president of the Delaware State Bar Association Law Section, Corporate Law Section, excuse me, Elon Musk Fan Club. It's Chance from Chancery Daily. What's up?
Present.
And we also, of course, have super producer Carl with us, making sure this all sounds wonderful. And our ex officio member is here for some reason, Senator Chris Coons. Hey.
Has anyone seen Tom? He said he was just coming here for the pizza, but now I can't find him.
Man, that's weird.
No. Now that he's a lame duck, he just spends his time trawling the streets of Wilmington looking for a good slice. And of course, now it's my responsibility to bring him back for votes whenever Joe needs to approve a new weapons shipment.
All right, brother.
While I am here, though, do you have a moment to talk about sensible tax policy in Singapore and how it can supercharge Delaware
investment? Get the fuck out of here.
Fine. Though if you see Tom, do not let him have any pepperoni.
Everyone, that was very strange, but he's gone. He's gone. And he's gone, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. Frankly, I don't even know why he was here. So I want to get right to it tonight. Everybody knows why we're here. We're here because of the process and the franchise. We've talked to Hal Weitzman. We've talked to Chance before. We've covered this in the call. But it's happening, as they say in Twin Peaks, it's happening again. Before we get to this year's changes, who made them, why they made them, and what the problem with them is... Jordan, do you just want to cover sort of the process itself and how this section of the corporate bar sort of just proposes these changes and they're sort of shepherded through and what they affect and why this is important? Just give us the sort of the 5-minute overview.
Yeah, and so we I think we initially were covering this in the call and talked about it last year with the AMC amendments to the Delaware General Corporation law. And what basically happens is that every year a group of attorneys that are in the State Bar Association, in a special subcommittee rather within the State Bar Association, get together and talk about what changes they think should be made to Delaware's corporate code. And this is oftentimes driven by how cases turned out in the Chancery Court or the Delaware Supreme Court. What was the old saying, or what was the saying that it's like, how you know what the amendments are going to be? You know how it goes.
Exactly. Fans. You know, that's how you figure out what next year's amendments are going to look like. Which, you know, cases did defendants lose last year?
Yeah. What cases did the big, deep pocketed, big money clients lose? And those will be the changes to the corporate code. And it's more or less gone on like this for decades, with oftentimes not significant amendments being proposed by the Delaware, by the State Bar Association, but a lot of tinkering around the edges, a lot of fine tuning. But, you know, this year, if you've been following the call, you'll know, is a little bit different. Actually, last year was a little bit different too. 2 years in a row now, you know, we have some pretty big changes to the corporate code. And so after the State Bar Association writes the amendments and votes to approve them, they send the amendments to friendly legislators in the General Assembly. I think it usually starts out in the Senate. Usually your Brian Townsends of the world or your Kyle Evan Gays are, going to be your sponsors because they have you know, close relationships with, you know, the State Bar Association and some of the corporate lawyers who work there. And then usually, like, after that, much nothing else really happens. Right?
Well, that's the
There's
one thing,
almost no debate, no the deliberation.
The thing that you've pointed out in these stories, which I think is important, is it's sort of a... It's sort of a jumping off point of sort of where this all started is last year on the last day on the floor, the bill came, but Medina and team were prepared to make a cogent argument, a cogent legal argument about why this was a bad idea. And 11 people voted for that amendment. Now, 11's obviously not enough, but it's was an unprecedented move. That was last year. Now, this year is even more unprecedented than that. Thank goodness the chances here, as a huge sort of follower of all things judicial, with the big Hunter Biden case, you're here for to share the laptop documents with us. Thank God now we can talk to you about this with use your other expertise, not the laptop and like all that expertise. But can you sort of explain? What particular about this change? And actually, I'll just tell you this story, and then you can go. We were out somewhere socially, and I overheard Jordan talking to someone that like just a mutual friend, and I realized, oh, maybe it was at the Dumpster Funk
and George Clinton
Parliament, right?
Show.
And I realized he was explaining the Mullis case to like a random person, and I went, are you explaining the Mullis case to this person? He was like, he's like, I am.
No choice.
The person is a Delaware resident, and it is a public interest.
So the reason that this particular set of changes that has been submitted to the General Assembly is so controversial is basically boils down to this Mullis case, how it was decided, and what they're trying to change. So I think this is a good time for you to kind of give us that, because you're the person who understands that for sure.
Sure. So, I mean, it's funny because, you know, last time I was in the bunker, it was last year, and we were about the same, maybe a little bit earlier last year, but similar time of year. We were in a similar position with the amendments last year. And I think it's almost, I don't know what the word is, it's almost unfair to even compare what is going on this year with what went on last year. What went on last year, to be clear, I thought was unfair. I thought it was a abuse of power, in a sense, to make the kind of changes that were made last year around the AMC case and sort of... But that, in hindsight, was almost trivial compared to the kinds of changes that are attempting to be made this year. And so, you know, opponents of this bill are being called alarmists. And of course, when you're being called an alarmist, it's hard not to sound like an alarmist, especially when you're very alarmed about something. And I will tell you that, you know, myself and others and upwards of maybe 100 law professors and other neutrals who don't have a vested economic interest in Delaware corporate law being one way or another favorable to managers over stockholders or what have you, a lot of people are very alarmed about these changes. And I'll just try to give you a 101 sort of, it's hard not to get into the weeds on these things because they are complex, but I really, really want to try to give a comprehensible take on what is actually going on here. So in the Mullis case, what was being looked at were these things called stockholder agreements. Now, we start right off the bat and we have confusing terminology because for many decades, a stockholder agreement was basically understood to be mostly something that was an agreement between stockholders. So if you think that you have the company and then you have the sort of directors of the company who under Delaware law are the ones who are supposed to manage and run the company. And then you have stockholders who are the owners of the company, but they are not, they don't have their fingers in the day-to-day pie of how things go, right? That's the job of the directors. And Delaware has been a director-centric state, director-centric code. That is our, it is like, it is so fundamental to what Delaware has always been. It's hard to overstate sort of the centrality of that premise. And So you had these stockholders agreements, and mostly what was referred to by that term were agreements between stockholders. So like maybe a bunch of stockholders wanted to get together and say, hey, we're going to vote against this thing, or we're going to, like, you know, sort of team up and have a bit more power because we'll have like a voting block, right? Those kind of stockholder agreements are not super controversial. They are what they are. They have, there are rules around what can and cannot be in them, et cetera. That's not what we're talking about now. Sometime in the last, we're not really sure exactly when this really started to morph. I'm sure there are historians that are getting more familiar, but the problem is that a lot of these agreements happen in private companies where there is no reason for them to be disclosed, and they are not disclosed. So even scraping data on how these agreements actually look out in the world is difficult. But we're calling this episode Market Practice, and that's because at some point in the past several decades, market practice, meaning the things that lawyers are actually out there in the world advising their clients and their client corporations to do, was developed into, in various situations, there being agreements that a stockholder, a single stockholder, would sign with the company. And then we started calling those stockholder agreements too, which is kind of fucking confusing because now you've got like two very different types of documents that are being called the same thing. So first thing to do is to understand that the type of stockholder agreement that was at issue in Moelis was an agreement between a single stockholder, Moelis, and the company, which is Moelis and Company. But you can see there's already kind of an identity of interest between the controller and the company, right? But these agreements, it turns out that now we're sort of finding out. I mean, apparently people have known this for a long time, but we're sort of discovering that the breadth of these agreements has become wild, right? So there are apparently agreements that this legislation is attempting to authorize that would allow a single stockholder. In fact, the legislation goes so far as to allow a prospective stockholder, which is not a defined term, by the way. So take it for what you will. A prospective stockholder might be somebody who intends someday to buy a single share of a company. A stockholder, certainly, undeniably under the law as proposed, could own a single share of stock and could enter an agreement into an agreement with the company to control the actions of the board of directors and to do all sorts of other things.
That's so. Let me try to sum it up and make sure I understand.
Yes,
because I've been
please.
Listening to you and reading Jordan. So generally, the board of directors, whether it's private or public company, is the people who represent the shareholders'
exactly.
interests generally, and generally that's how it goes. A stockholder agreement isn't necessarily a bad thing. They've been used generally under a general term for probably a very long time,
yes.
but they've become something under the same term, stockholder agreement. They've become something that not only is it a side deal where one person can usurp the directors, it's also, which I didn't understand until actually you just said it, a potential stockholder, which isn't even a thing. So it's like almost like you could take a bribe. Like you could say, well, I'm going to do this if you can tell me that I can sign an agreement that's going to go around the board of directors.
Right.
Right. Is that
yeah.
what it is? Like,
I mean,
just a novice. That's what it sounds like to me.
I mean, look, the scope of these amendments as they are written and you know, the CLC and the folks who drafted the actual legislation, which, by the way, in Delaware is not the legislators. It's fine. It's attorneys who, quote, know what they are doing. But the people who drafted this legislation will say repeatedly, oh, we didn't intend for it to have these implications. But I will tell you that anyone who knows anything about legislation knows that intent is you only get to intent if you go down a whole certain road. What really matters is what does the language of the statute say? And we've had lots of commentary from a sitting vice chancellor on LinkedIn explaining how, as a member of the judiciary who would be called upon to interpret this statute, the statute is on its face incomprehensible in a lot of ways, or it just clearly allows for an insane breadth of actions under these type of stockholder agreements. So if you want to think about an analogy, and this is, you know, maybe not a perfect analogy, but I think it's a powerful one because, Hey, if anyone listening out there has a rebuttal to this analogy, please, you know, email me,
email highlandsbunker @gmail.com.
Okay,
we'll put that right in spam.
Exactly.
We don't care what you think. Fuck it. We're putting that right in the trash.
I genuinely want to know, like, what is the rebuttal to this? Because here's the analogy. Imagine that you're running for legislature. You know, you want to be on the Delaware state legislature. You do whatever you do. You canvass your district. You go out and you try to get votes. And some of these races in Delaware are decided by like a handful or dozens of votes, right? They are close races. You're going out and meeting with constituents and...
Carl just fainted.
telling them your positions and you're, you know, doing all this sort of like good faith, you know, hopefully kind of, you know, articulation of your positions and how you will represent your constituents once you get into office. But then imagine that you get to Dover or whatever on the first day of your first session and someone pulls you aside. You know, you have your sort of things planned. You've got your agendas, you know, all set up. But someone pulls you aside and says, oh, I just not sure if anyone's let you know yet, but Delaware signed the equivalent of a stockholders agreement with some private equity firm. So you're actually not allowed to vote the way you want to vote or the way your constituents want you to vote. You have to vote for this agenda and this. Oh, and by the way, if there anything else comes up during the session that's not on this list, you have to consult with me first and you have to get my approval to say anything, do anything, make any public statements. And this is literally the equivalent of what will happen in the corporate democracy context if this statute passes as it is written. I have not heard a good faith argument for how that is not a perfect analogy. But I will tell you that I think it would freak legislators out if they were suddenly told they can't vote for their constituents or the way they said they would or the way that they believe that they should for the best interests of the state.
Because it doesn't matter what they do because there's a side bet. There's a side deal.
Right. It's not that it wouldn't matter. It's that they would have to vote a certain way.
So they're mandated to do X, Y.
These agreements can say things like the board of directors have to consult with me, Mr. Controlling Single stockholder. They have to consult with me before any vote, and they have to vote the way that I want them to vote. They can say things.
I do want to say something because I want to get into like the controversy about it, or I shouldn't even say controversy, just the dissent,
right.
The unprecedented dissent, right. I guess we would say. But before that, I do want to mention the intent piece of it. Because it's really easy to say, well, we wrote it in a sloppy sort of open way, and we don't intend for, like, the worst thing to happen, but inherent in it is the worst thing could happen. And I would argue, just from a philosophical or sort of logical standpoint, not really a legal standpoint, the reason that the stockholder agreement went from a thing where, because you own stock, you could make an agreement to vote as a block, to what it is today, and you can pretend that it's market practice, is because it wasn't intended to do that, but everything's going to naturally lead towards loopholes and more control, autocracy, undemocratic stuff, illegal stuff. And so the thing that really clicked this off is Vice Chancellor Laster wrote an opinion in this case, Molas, to basically say, yeah, this is actually illegal. This isn't really what a stockholder agreement's supposed to be. This, you can't do this because it's undemocratic. Like nobody would buy a share in a company knowing that it doesn't really matter if you buy the share or not because you're not buying anything. You don't have any. You have no stake.
You have no.
You're not a stakeholder.
No one's representing you.
You're not a stakeholder.
No, you're just. You're, I guess, a dividend. You're receiving a dividend.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Right? If the controlling stockholder who has the agreement does things that might result in a dividend, but you know, who knows? Who's to say that that's going to happen, right? So yeah, I mean, no, I mean, it seems obvious. I think to right-thinking people that anything that is possible to do under the law is going to be done and then some, right? That's literally what you just said. That's how we got here. We got here because we had a thing that was, you know, okay, it was cool to have stockholder agreements. Then they morphed into this really crazy beast. And now the best argument from the proponents of this legislation is we have to bring the law into alignment with market practice, which I'll translate for you means We wrote the lawyers who are proposing this legislation, wrote tens of thousands of agreements that are now void ab initio, which means they never basically even existed under the Moles decision. And that's not okay for companies, which I get it, right? There is some sort of legitimate seed underneath this entire thing that probably has to be reckoned with. We have to find a way to fix the fuck up of all of these lawyers
of
who recommended
it get this far.
Right, of how we let it get this far. And we whoever was that was writing or advising someone to write these tens of thousands of agreements that are out there now that are actually void ab initio under the current law. Well, right, that's a fucking problem, but it's not. Like, I don't see why it has to be everyone's problem that happened, right? There should be some sort of discussion about a solution, but I don't feel like the people who are going to get, it's like a bailout for the lawyers who drafted 10,000 bad agreements under the law. This legislation is a bailout for them. It's a wiping out of all of the bad, it's retroactive on those agreements. And the only agreements that are not covered retroactively are ones that have pending litigation on them, which is like a fractional, you know, a minuscule amount. But also that becomes pretty ridiculous because those companies could just enter into new. There are loopholes sort of around the sort of tiny little carve out of retroactivity. The functional reality is that this is retroactive to wipe out the mistakes of. We can say they were the lawyers' mistakes. You can say they were the company's mistakes. Somebody fucked up and did all of this. And this is an argument on the record that people are making out loud. They're not ashamed of saying this. We have to get the law in alignment with market practice. And, you know, I've gone around a lot of sort of thinking about what that means to have a regime where you allow market practice to get out of control. And then you come to the legislature and you say, you have to save us. You have to fix this. You have to make this legal, what we've done. You have to make this okay, what we have done in the past. Like, that is not the way that I think it should work, because a lot of things are, quote, market practice. A lot of things are, quote, the way it's done that are not things that we want to legitimize.
The whole point of having a law, as our friend Professor Dale Norwood, the great historian at the University of Delaware, said when sort of discussing this, it's like, what other thing can you think of where it's like, we've been doing this illegal thing, market practice, like selling, he's like, you could sell ketamine. And you're like, you're selling, always been doing this. That's how people get it. And the market tells us that a black market's going to get us this good price. So can't you just make it legal?
Right.
Like, we've been doing it. I mean, yeah. we've been doing it, and doing it.
So market practice. Subprime loans, right?
Market
right?
practice. Yeah. Yeah.
Market practice.
Asbestos was market practice, right? I mean,
yeah, it's a ridiculous sort of concept when applied to this idea of stockholder agreements, when it's just like, yeah. And then on top of it, talking about that intent just drives me nuts, because it's like, the reason you got to this point is because you wrote something open to sort of allow as much as you could allow. Okay. And that's why we're in the situation we're in.
Just want to quote from the Mullis decision here, since we're talking about market practice, you know, what Vice Chancellor Laster said, what happens when the seemingly irresistible force of market practice meets the traditionally immovable object of statutory law? A court must uphold the law so the statute prevails. And that's his reasoning as a judge.
That's actually the perfect. That's right. That's it.
And so the response to that was, change the statute.
Change the fucking law.
Right?
Yeah. So let's get to some of the dissenting sort of pockets, because it's really, really unprecedented. I guess, first of all, we'll talk about sort of in academia and sort of in the experts and attorneys and writers who follow this and journalists who follow this. There's a huge amount that are up in arms. But, of course, the second argument we're hearing is these are all sort of, as you said, alarmist, right. outsider agitators.
I am no longer an outsider.
First of all, yes,
I am back home. This is it.
So as you may know, Chance for a period of time was living in the state of Texas in the Great Lone Star State, has now moved back to Milton, Delaware.
Yeah, baby.
So listen, she's not an outside agitator. Uh-uh. She's an inside agitator.
The call is coming from inside the house.
Yeah, it's an inside agitator. So that's happening. But the biggest thing is, first of all, we're getting a lot of words from the Honorable Travis Laster in the last couple of weeks, which is completely unprecedented. He's been writing, because he wrote the opinion, he's been writing just for himself, clearly with a disclaimer, about his thoughts, sort of about this. And they've
just
been,
me as a human being and not a judge.
He's
right?
posting not as a vice chancellor. That's his yeah.
Can you, LinkedIn so
profile.
So you had it up before. We were gonna read some sections because the thing is that there's the joke that sort of when you get caught up in any kind of controversy like this, you know, you just post through it. But you don't really ever hear, like, on the Court of Chancery, like, a vice chancellor posting through it. Like, you're not, it's not it really,
not
it's a
common,
very new thing.
Right.
Can you be like, man, they almost got banned from Facebook. Who was it? Oh, it's Vice Chancellor Laster. He got banned.
He's
going crazy. Yeah.
Throttled by LinkedIn.
He's getting throttled. He's in the algorithm.
Ban, yeah.
He's in the algorithm. Yeah. He's been banned for one day. He can't like or retweet. He can only look.
Well, you know, where are all those social media companies incorporated?
Right.
Now, right. Where? Yeah,
again, I mean,
it's dicey. It's a pretty risky move for him.
You know?
But
know
here's
that.
The thing. You know, it is a pretty risky move for him, in fact, like, not even joking, because there are people that are, they do have a significant overlap with the people who are proponents of this legislation and who would be beneficiaries of it, in the sense that they would be bailed out from all the bad agreements that their clients entered into, just so happens. But those people are very, very upset that he is posting as a member of the judiciary. And ironically, or I don't even know if irony is the right word, but there's this whole thing like, oh, it's a harumph, you know, like, I can't believe that a sitting member of the judiciary is commenting on legislation on a pending case. And
what
it's
a
like,
break with tradition.
Right?
Oh,
well,
this
well,
is
here's
not
the
this
thing.
Is not the norms we
right.
all agreed
the
to.
The norm, in fact, is that you do not propose legislation on a case that has not even had an opportunity to be appealed to the Delaware Supreme Court. So
and that's
talking
an important
about,
part that people maybe don't understand.
Right.
So Vice Chancellor Laster wrote the opinion in the Court of Chancery and basically ruled sort of these kind of agreements are illegal for the reasons we just said. That actually can still be appealed to the Delaware Supreme
yeah,
Court,
if he got
which
it
has
wrong.
Not happened
right.
yet. And but we're still, again, just like we were last year, sort of interjecting ourselves
yeah.
into this.
In way worse. I mean, last year there wasn't really, look, the AMC appeal actually did just, you know, get affirmed by the Supreme Court. But the AMC case was weird because it was in a settlement posture. It was like not exactly where...
Because didn't the people had to agree to the settlement
yeah.
before it was
and
final
the court
or
had
something
to agree.
Like that? Yeah.
The court had to approve the settlement. It was a slightly different posture. There is nothing nuanced about the way that this is being intercepted at the Court of Chancery level. And it is literally unprecedented for this to happen. You know, we made the joke last year, we made it again today about how normally like the legislation that's proposed by the CLC is something that, you know, remedies the unjust travesty of a plaintiff winning a case once in a while in Delaware. And, you know, and that's usually like got a year or so lag, right? You have a case that defendants don't like, they put forward a change, you know, that does some minor tweak, right? You know, you can debate whether how to what degree those have been sort of egregious moves in the past. Mostly they probably have not been. This one. So the thing that I mentioned about the director centrism of Delaware is codified in the Delaware General Corporation Law as 141A. This legislation will completely undermine 141A, which is like saying, I don't even know. It's like you're destroying a hallmark of what makes Delaware corporate law Delaware
like
corporate
the keystone
law. Exactly. It's just like
doorway,
it's like
right?
it is the thing that holds it together. It is the but for of Delaware yeah. corporate law. And it is just, I mean, I think, you know, here's the problem. Legislators in Delaware are part-time legislators. They are, I think, for the most part, as far as I can tell, mostly well-meaning, mostly well-intentioned folks who really try to do a good job for their various, you know, constituencies. However, when it comes to corporate law, it is a complex subject. It is nuanced. It is also very easy to talk over someone's head to the point where they can't understand anything that you're saying, especially if you prefer to obfuscate or not have them understand the implications of the legislation that you're asking them to pass. But, you know, they try hard to understand these things, but they have a sort of vibe that's like, you know, it's just better if we just trust the lawyers. I'm not a lawyer, a lot of them will say, even some of them, or I'm not a corporate lawyer if they are a JD, you know, and they have this sort of feeling like they don't get it enough to take a strong stand, even if they do kind of start to understand what's going on. And that's tough because here we have, you know, look, the folks who proposed this legislation, they are skilled advocates. They are, they know how to win an argument. So it's difficult if they're not really engaging in a good faith debate about the merits of the issues to talk back and forth with them. I mean, we had a corporation law section meeting. We had two, actually. And there was no meaningful discussion. And if you say that, I heard someone say it after the meeting to one of the chairs of the meeting, and he, again, harumphed, like, of course we want to have open and honest debate about this. I can't believe that anyone, literally every person except for all the first year, you know, lawyers who the firms, like, brought in droves just to sit there and act like they knew what was going on. Everyone there who knew what these amendments were about felt like there was no opportunity for a good faith discussion. It was the first time, I think, in a long time, in anyone's memory, probably back to the 102b7 amendments, that there was real dissent within the corporation law section. They didn't even give us a vote once they did. They did some revisions, right? So it turned.
Well, notably, too, the final vote of this,
right,
there were dissents in the voting.
Absolutely.
Which I don't know. I mean, this is usually not just sort of sails right through. There was public dissent at the executive
committee level, and at the corporation law section level, there was even more dissent. But they didn't even give us a vote on the second, so they did make some like minor revisions. It turns out that the minor revisions didn't clear anything up, didn't resolve any of the problems, and actually introduced some new, really kind of crazy problems that could
be like, yeah, we actually made it worse.
Right. But we
classic,
listened
that's
to
a classic
all
Delaware
right
way move. The classic Delaware way move.
We listened to all of your complaints.
To not listen.
And we made
say
changes.
You listened and then make it worse. Yeah. That's actually three. That's the three, almost the three,
it's
main tenets. That's the three main tenets.
So, you know, and then we didn't get a second vote on the second version because the first vote had gone, you know, there was 25, 30 some percent of the lawyers in the corporation law section voted against these amendments when we did have a vote. Now, that didn't mean anything because it still went to the executive committee. I think it was pretty historic that there were at least two no votes and some abstentions in the executive committee. These things just usually go through with no comment whatsoever. But, you know, I'm not sure if it's a feature of people never having really paid attention or if it really is just, you know, that they're getting bolder and bolder in what they're trying to change, or if it's a confluence of both things. But, you know, now with eyes on, it's so clear, right? So you have both Chancellor McCormick writing a letter to the executive committee of the Delaware State Bar Association that just clearly says, right, there are actually three decisions that these amendments in total are addressing. And the MOLIS section is by far attacking, like Bill said, the keystone of Delaware corporate law. So it's the one that everyone is focusing on. The other ones are like not quite as, you know, crazy, but also have real big sort of drafting flaws and things that are unclear. The whole thing was done. The MOLIS decision came out at the end of February. These amendments were put forth just months after that. We had maybe 6 days to read them before the corporation law section voted. Just an insane amount of time for a practicing lawyer or anyone else really to get up to speed on something that's so complex and then have an informed view about it and then be able to argue against, you know, like I say, skilled rhetoricians who are proposing these amendments who will just continually say to your face, that's not our intention, even though you're reading the words on the page and you understand that it really doesn't matter.
Yeah,
so
as
much.
I said before, I think the important issue there, if you're somebody who, you know, doesn't necessarily feel comfortable because you can be sort of like razzle-dazzled into not really
right
understanding, if you can understand this point, it's one of the most important ones, their intention doesn't matter.
Right.
Like, everyone knows that. If you just think about general law, like, however you write it, whatever you intended it to mean actually doesn't matter, and we're going to fight about it later if you don't make it clearer. And we're probably still going to fight about it later anyway.
Right.
But that's the whole point. The whole point is you have to make sure that what you intend, that you don't write something that does something you didn't intend.
Right.
So if anybody says we didn't intend it, just be like, well, that's irrelevant.
It doesn't matter.
Shut up.
Right.
Don't ever say that again.
And the worst part about all this is that, you know, you have Vice Chancellor Laster explaining that as a sitting member of the bench, he's not sure how he would interpret certain of these statutory provisions because they are, I mean, the one, there's the Stephen Bainbridge quote that's kind of famous that from Twitter. You know, Stephen Bainbridge is a corporate law professor who is historically, he and I love him, but we fight about everything, right? We disagree on every fundamental matter of Delaware corporate law. Great guy, very smart, written all the, when I was in law school, all my casebooks were Stephen Bainbridge casebooks. But he said, this is the worst drafted piece of legislation he has ever seen. He said, start over, go back to the drawing board. And you know what? Nobody cares because we're just a bunch of outside agitators, neutrals who don't really. The retort is always they're not looking at it in the fullness of.
They're not looking at it. If I may interject here, because here's this is the crux of it. Before we get to like what can be done, because there's actually a Senate committee hearing coming up that we want to talk about a little bit. But let's be real clear. I think, in my opinion, when people say that here, when they say these are outside agitators, they don't know how things are done here, they don't understand what they mean is there's a product behind all this, and the product isn't necessarily perfectly legal, and it's not necessarily, if we explained it to you in clear terms, you might not like it. And unfortunately, we've based a lot of our shit on this. And, you know, we just got to do it because we fucked up. We based all of our shit on this. So it's like, and that's really, that's the bill of goods that's being sold here. And I also want to mention before we go forward, too, is that Representative Emeritus John Kowalko was in here. Two weeks ago, and brought up the fact that the individuals who are always tasked with shepherding this through the legislature are always, as you mentioned, Chance, part-time legislators because they're moonlighting in Leg Hall. What they really do for a living is they're corporate attorneys in Wilmington, and you know we should just say that. The sponsor of this amendment, Brian Townsend, is a corporate attorney.
Yeah, and starting a new private equity practice at Morris James.
New private equity.
And private equity are the folks who are, you know, kind of the most.
PE, little PE.
And the PE.
A lot of these agreements are with PE firms.
No, this is because all the ones that were, the 10,000, those were all. This whole thing is a gift to private equity.
Yeah. Right? This is a. This is a long. You know what this is? This is a long walk to private equity. I've walked. I got out of Robben Island. I got my resume together, and I got a job in private equity. I mean, that's what the book was about, right?
Can I just add something really quick since we were talking about intent? And can I share with you what I think is one of the most sensational claims of what, you know, this new legislation would allow in terms of, like, we were talking about, you know, the centricity of the board in terms of Delaware, you know, corporate law. And I'm going to mention this sensationalist claim because it has all the perfect buzzwords. And some people will love it and some people will hate it. But according to one of the earliest analysis of this bill by Vice Chancellor Laster, he said something to the extent of, without revisions, this would allow AI into the boardroom and AI to make decisions in place of the board. And I just think that there are people out there who think that is great. That is so cool, man. Yes.
Right?
On just untold levels of synergy. We're about to reach so much more synergy.
Because just like you can say,
with this AI
just
board,
like you can say,
you know what? All of those people should get on Elon Musk's rocket and go to Mars. If you believe that that's good and allowing that is good, get on that fucking rocket and take thee to fucking Mars. Get out.
Yeah. It's funny. I just got an email today from the State Bar Association promoting some like AICLE later this summer.
Oh, nice.
I see some great synergy.
Yeah, great synergy.
That's right. So we have Brian Townsend, who, you know, all due respect, you're in the middle of some messy stuff. I mean, you have aspirations to do this private equity. I didn't even know about that. I mean, other stuff like, you know, official state officials and judiciary shit. It's crazy. Yeah. The chair of the Senate committee who will be hearing this hearing next week on Tuesday, Kyle Evans-Gay, what does she do for her job? Does anybody know?
I believe she's a lawyer.
She's a corporate attorney. So again, you know, these people have a vested interest in this. I think I will say this, as Chance said earlier. Do I think that the people have sort of nefarious sort of ideas about what they're doing? No, I think they're just doing their job.
Yeah.
I think people just feel like, hey, I'm in the army. I'll just do the thing that they do.
I mean, I was on a CLE last month with Brian Townsend, and no, I'm sure he's a busy guy, and no offense to him, but he had no idea what these amendments were about when they were first proposed, because they're written by, you know, the corporate law council, and then they're handed, literally, we joked about this last year, but when the draft goes out every single year, and they didn't bother to fix it this year, because apparently they're proud of it, it has a bracketed part that says, insert sponsors here. And if you know anything about anything, it kind of like makes you wonder, like, huh, the people who are going to be, you know, basically vouching for this in the legislature, they had no part in drafting it, not even conceptually sort of understanding what's going on. And again, these are realities of the part-time legislature in Delaware. And many people would, you know, mock me for being such a naive that I think that it's a bad thing, because they would probably partly rightly say, look, these issues are way too complex to leave them to a part-time legislature, right? They couldn't manage to keep the DGCL up to date without the assistance of corporate lawyers. However, when you only listen to the corporate lawyers who have gotten us into this position where we have all these agreements that violate the law, and you won't listen to neutrals, law professors, you know, sitting members of the judiciary, and you won't listen to people who don't have a vested monetary interest in this changing, well, then we're not really having a good faith discussion about the issues. We're just pushing forward someone's agenda.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this, actually, because we just booked a 300th episode. We're recording it next week, and the person who's coming in, who I'm not going to name right now, would have an opinion about some of this process. And the thing I've been thinking about is, like, okay, if you want to make an argument that, like, the biggest experts in the world need to be the ones doing this, okay. But then when the other experts in the world are like, what the fuck are you doing?
Right.
And point out that it's like in the middle of this sort of like weird sort of like legal situation. They're trying to end run boards of directors. They're reverse engineering stuff that got fucking turned in the court of chancery. When like other people point that out, the only redress we have, the only democratic redress we have, is in that goddamn pit of despair,
right?
That den of iniquity in Dover.
Totally.
That's the only place we can go.
Well, that's what drives me nuts, is because, you know, the logical thing to do is fight this on the process. They promised last year, and Carl can play the clip, perhaps, where Medina got a promise on the floor of the House that they would not do this again, that the legislature would have more time to actually think about and digest these corporate law bills.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We just voted on a very important bill that will have ripple effects, not just in the issue area that the amendment was proposed to address, but in the general corporation law in general. And so I would just like to put on the record that I think it's important that in the future we deliberate on these bills, not on June 30th, but earlier in session, so we can have actual conversations on it. And the bill should have a committee hearing where the public is able to speak and voice their concerns about the bill. Yesterday, I believe, and today, the AMC case started, and all eyes are on Delaware again. And so it's really important that we are taking our job seriously and mm-hmm. deliberating over bills like this, and not just voting on them because the Corporation Law Council asks us to. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Griffith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Representative Wilson-Anton. I've spoken already with Mr. Raju, who will be the chair next year of Corporation Law Council, and he's agreed that we will be meeting about this, and he'll be bringing forward these issues to our General Assembly earlier in the year so that we can address them earlier. Thank you.
And then it sort of was, you know, just all that happened was it was five times as worse this year. It was later in the year. It was a way bigger amendment and no time to sort of think through it. The problem that I have with, like, fighting it on the process so much is because it's like, what? What are we going to ask for? I mean, it'd be great, in my opinion, if this thing did not pass this year, because it needs to be rethought. However, I fear that we will spend the next year just hoping to be forgotten about and hoping that people lose steam for rethinking it. And then the same damn thing will be proposed next year. It will just be in this. So it's like there isn't an opportunity in the current system for meaningful debate among reasonable minds who are experts in the field. There is only the input of the Corporation Law Council with purported input from the Corporation Law Section. But I will tell you, I have spoken to many, many members who were at that meeting, many of whom spoke and said things and still didn't feel heard or addressed or considered, even though they had the technical ability to say words in public. It didn't make any difference. And so without like a meaningful process change, I don't see how this really gets any better in the long term. I mean, I really think that one personal, you know, thing I think would personally be great is if the legislature could have a body of experts who could receive the legislation from the Corporation Law Council, actually consider it with time and attention, and then sort of have some sort of triage process for this. Because right now there is no meaningful debate on the Corporation Law Council side. There just isn't, even though they will be so offended if they hear that I said that. They will probably try to cancel their subscriptions to our publication. They have done this in recent past. They will try to do anything to get me to shut up
about this process. No, you're not going to cancel your subscription to Chancery Daily. Come on.
That's malpractice, technically, you know, like, so don't do that.
I do say, you know, a lot of people are kind of petty about this. You're not going to cancel your subscription to the publication. Stop. Just stop.
The whole thing about this also that just is so illogical is they're like, oh, well, we need to, we need to listen to the experts on this one. And the Corporate Law Council, they're the experts. But then if you ask people, why do corporations incorporate in Delaware? And they often say, oh, it's because of our courts. And, you know, our courts are the experts on this. Our courts know how to how to rule on these situations. And it's like, okay, well, then.
Because why the court's supposed to execute the plan.
Why isn't Laster being considered an expert here? Right. Why isn't McCormick being considered an expert when these people are saying we're listening to the experts? It's like, you sell, like, this state sells the Chancery Court like a product to the country, saying you come here and your corporate, like, you know, litigation, your corporate disputes, it'll go, like, we have a fast track, you know, process for you to go through. We have these expert judges who just, like, all they do is this, and we're going to reach an equitable agreement. But now all of a sudden those judges, I guess, aren't experts, well, look, and they shouldn't be listened to. It's ridiculous.
They should be made fun of in random emails.
There's a dark side to this, too, which is, you know, that back in when I graduated in 2009, I really wanted, I worked for Professor Wachter at Penn. I was obsessed with corporate law. I summered at Skadden 2 years in a row.
The big boys.
Ooh, boy. And I loved corporate law, and I wanted to practice in corporate law so badly. But when I graduated, I realized that I could not see myself litigating in the Court of Chancery because it was a old boys club that was so dark and clandestine and smoky roomed kind of. It was just not a place that I felt comfortable. And the reality is that in the last 15 years, that has changed dramatically. And I feel comfortable there now. And that fact bothers a lot of people, right? The fact that there has been a shift in the court. It's run by a woman. It has actually almost gender balance on it. It has balance of ideas. They, you know, McCormick and Laster represent a sort of, you know, a position that is not so knee-jerk defense unfriendly, like defense friendly. They are not knee-jerk defense friendly in a way that bothers the defense. So there's this kind of like thing percolating in the air that the bar is generally just kind of upset that the bench doesn't really reflect their wants and needs anymore like it used to. Like, they used to be basically jump and judiciary said, how high do you need it today? And they were like, oh, whenever. And it was just kind of, you know, they were bros and whatever. And that was how it worked. Look, I'm not saying anything against those jurists. They probably just like were operating. It was the water that they swam in, right? It was just the way that things worked here. And it does not work that way anymore. And people are bent about it. And so there's a nefarious way to look at this, which is that it is an explicit attack on the judiciary. It is an explicit attempt to undermine their authority. It is an attempt literally to overrule three of their recent opinions without them even having the opportunity to be appealed to the Delaware Supreme Court. It is just a facial front attack on the court. And honest to God, someone said something like so politely to that effect at the corporation law section meeting, and they said, oh my God, it is not our intent to diminish the judiciary in any way.
Clutch your pearls.
Right, exactly. Their pearls were crushed in their hands. I mean, and it was, you know, it's like the offense that is taken at any suggestion of what is, I think, probably whether a conscious or unconscious reality is, you know, it's
absurd. There's another interesting aspect of the Delaware way that I think you were describing. It's this idea that, like, generally, in this situation, if you take like personalities out of it, when the corporate, well, first of all, Laster wouldn't have even made probably this decision necessarily, but then he made the decision, and when the corporate law section was going to overturn him 10 years ago, 15 years ago, whoever is in that position just has to eat shit.
Right.
They can't, there's no mechanism for them to like get the word out. They just have to eat shit. And so whoever the establishment Delaware way institutions are, whether they're the Bar Association, the Chamber of Commerce, the police, the state police, these groups, they're used to just being like, we're doing this. And whoever else in our group is sort of like, oh, you're going over top. This just has to fucking eat it. I mean, we have that situation now. I would be remiss not to point out that our governor, you know, he was a U.S. rep, and he couldn't even be elected to the governor, right? And then he gets elected to the governor, and the last governor gets to be the ambassador to Italy and live in Villa Taverna, they call it, in a villa in Italy. Markel, Ambassador Markel, I call
him. To Italy and San Marino.
And San Marino. We call him Ambassador Markel, just to be clear.
Ambassador Markel. Are you running for mayor?
Just to be clear. Now, what previous U.S. representative and two-term governor of Delaware, John Carney, gets to do is run for Pazicki's third term. Because he's an old boy network, eat shit. Because he's going to eat shit. Because he's a loser. But there are people around now that are like, well, I don't think that's right.
So I don't like the taste of shit.
Yeah, I don't like that. That doesn't make any sense. Like, Laster's like, yeah, I mean, you can't just have one guy run the whole company. That's crazy. And then they were like, well, we actually want one guy to run the whole company. Right. Laster's like, well, you know what? I'm not eating shit. Go fuck yourself. That's crazy. And I'm stepping up because this is fucking crazy.
Right. And I mentioned this at the executive committee meeting where they had I don't know how many minutes allotted to the whole presentation of these proposed amendments. But by the time they got around to the four of us who were there in opposition to it, they said, oh, we have about 6 minutes left. So
they gave it six minutes left.
And then they called me in, which was fine, nice of them, because I had followed the procedures to tell them I was coming and all. But like, there was another guy there who really had a lot prepared to say, and I was like, I am only speaking if you promise me you're gonna let the next guy go, because we just sat through an hour of listening to you all, you know, pontificate about why this is so great and why it's blah blah blah. And anyway, the thing that I said was, it's actually really existentially scary to speak up in Delaware.
Yes.
Because
that's an excellent point.
Even if you're a VC.
Even if you're a VC, yes. And no matter who you are, right? And especially if you're someone who doesn't have entrenched power. And so it's like, you know, I thought this was just so perfect too, because the piece came out, I don't know, was it last week? This piece came out in The Deal where they said that Vice Chancellor Laster and Chancellor McCormick writing a letter about the sort of rushed nature of these amendments and how, as experts, they thought that there were sort of problems with the way the language was drafted, et cetera, that them saying that was silencing defense attorneys who supported the bill into not speaking up about it. And I just thought, my God, you're like stealing the reality. You are just turning a reality on its head. Because
The Deal, you know what? Here's the thing about the publication of The Deal. They're gaslighting us.
Right?
You know what? More people should pay for Chancery Daily. Fuck The Deal. The Deal's garbage. They're trying to fucking gaslight us to tell us that the people speaking out
right.
are the people that are intimidating
right.
the people who have been in power for 250
right.
years.
Exactly.
Get
it's
the
like,
fuck out of here.
It's like the people that you're telling me that the proponents of the legislation who are literally have the power to write the words on the page, send them to the legislature, get 20 legislators to sign on as sponsors without thinking twice about it, put it forth in the legislature, are silenced somehow? It's their fucking idea. It's like, it was so nonsense. But the reality is, and like now that this silencing thing has been preempted by the other side, it's kind of crazy. But it's like, the reality is, I know tons and tons of lawyers in Delaware who cannot speak out about this because their firms won't let them, even though they are not defense firms. There is too much at stake in the petty ass, small minded nature of Delaware that they will lose referrals, they will lose income, they will lose money, because these things have happened to us, and we're just reporting. Look, we don't report like this in the publication. We report quite neutrally. But at some point, if you're not standing up for the truth, it's like, why are you even talking, right? So it's just the culture in Delaware has always been to shut up and sit down if you're not sort of going along to get along. And this is a perfect example of where we still, despite that fact, it is not safe for Vice Chancellor Laster and Chancellor McCormick to say anything. And they did it anyway, because this really matters. Not because they have some clients who need them to bail them out of something, or not because they're going to make money doing something. But this is, if anything, this is hurting them. It is hurting me to speak up about this. It is hurting the people who are speaking out against this. And if you look at the people's incentives who are involved in this, I think that it paints a pretty clear picture of what is actually going on. And the question is, will that matter enough to the people who do have a vote and who have sometimes exercised that vote kind of unconsciously? Are you going to get conscious about what is actually going on as a legislator and stop being a pawn and actually try, despite the fact that you probably don't have enough time, and I'm sure you legitimately don't, are going to try to get up to speed enough, at least on the dynamics and the politics behind how this has all arisen, to stop just letting your vote be taken for you?
Another Delaware Way tenant is the default position.
Right.
Because, like, again, this is the Dale Norwood was running into this with people he was talking to in the legislature. Right. It was like, well, the default position is, I don't understand, so I'm defaulting to the system.
Exactly.
Like, everybody's saying it's wrong, but, like, I'm just supposed to default to the system. Jordan, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Let's put out a PSA. If you are a corporate litigator in the state of Delaware who is too scared to speak out about Senate Bill 313, you can contact me on Signal at Bruce Goose, area code 302-440-3124. We can protect your anonymity.
We will absolutely protect your anonymity.
Could we do a Better Call Saul version of that?
We'll let you live here, and we know people that own guns.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it's like, it's insane to think at the amount of opposition this bill has, despite the fact that none of the people who are speaking up in opposition to it have a financial interest in it. In fact, the 60-some professors that are sort of being canvassed to come to Delaware, to Dover, Delaware, in the summertime when they are not working, are coming on their own dimes.
I want to introduce this because I want you to talk about sort of what's going to happen. So last year, as we said, they did this thing that Carl has explained many times here in the studio, walking a bill. It means you get the bill, and rather than have to waste time with the hearing, you just go, and then the floor votes on the bill. They call it walking it.
It walked itself right in.
It just walked itself right in. So that's just walked. Last year they walked it, and so Medina had to do the thing on the floor. That you guys just heard. This year, and you're hearing this on a Friday, which is what, the 6th? What's Friday? I think it's the 6th. 7th. If you're listening like you should, it's either the 7th, potentially it's the 8th, if you had a busy Friday.
Sometimes you don't get to it right at 8 a.m.
Well, sometimes, look, some people do. Our best fans do. Actually, probably of the people who get to it right at 8 a.m., it's a lot of haters, too.
Yeah.
It's like the 20 biggest haters.
If you're listening to this at 8:01, you might be a hater.
If you know who you are.
If you formulated an opinion about this by 9:30 on Friday, you fucking hate it.
If you are an aide in the General Assembly and it's your job to listen to this podcast... Because you have to be the person who conveys this hate to the haters who are your
boss.
Yeah,
you got to do. You have to write a report to Mimi Minor Brown and pretend like we said something about her and we didn't even say anything, and then she's just going to get mad. So the point is that next week on Tuesday, the 11th, at 10 a.m. inside the Senate chamber. Now, look, I know that I've said before that the leg call has bad vibes. They're terrible vibes. It's just filled with petty tyrants and thieves. But there are plans to have a proper committee hearing for once about this stuff in the Senate chamber in front of the Judiciary Committee. It is the Judiciary Committee, right? It's Kyle Evans Gay.
Yes, Senate.
Kyle's Senate Judiciary Committee. I saw the agenda for it today. So it was SB 313 and three other bills. And I just looked at the other bills and I'm like, well, they're not going to get a fucking hearing. I was like, you might as well. I saw like Baumbach had one like three now. And I'm like, Paul, you're not going to get a fucking hearing on this, buddy. We have big plans for that day. Chance, what have you been working on to kind of get this word out on the official record, so to speak?
I mean, the reality is that of the people who are opposed to this bill, I guess I don't see how you could argue that any of them have a vested economic or personal interest in it other than we give a shit about Delaware and we think that it's not the right thing for Delaware right now. We care about the franchise. I'm a Delaware resident. We make our living reporting on the courts. We want the courts to be a viable product, but so does the state. So should everyone in this state, because the courts, just like Jordan said, are the reason that companies incorporate here. We have a great Secretary of State, yada, yada, but the courts are the thing, right? And if we take away their power to even look at the way corporations are run, if we effectively just eviscerate the concept of fiduciary duties, which is what this bill will do, then corporations are going to go elsewhere. Look, I don't want to be alarmist about it, that, because I think that that argument is used as an alarm, you know, a false alarm signal so often when people want to get their way in Delaware. But that's when people want to get their way for some other economic interest, right? This is just like, this is not good if you believe that the system that we have works. And I do believe the system we have works. We have 2 million companies incorporated here. We have vibrant, robust courts, and they're nationally known and they are the best at what they do. So the people that are coming, I have, you know, invited, there are more than 60 law professors who have signed on to a joint letter, and getting 60 law professors to agree on anything, corporate law professors, is quite difficult, right? These people all have their own research agendas. They all have their own thinking that they do about things, but what they can agree on, and I think it's absolutely unprecedented to get that many lawyers, corporate law professors to agree on one thing. They agreed on, this is bad and you shouldn't do this, legislature. And so they signed a letter, and I've invited them to come to Dover, Delaware, as as attractive as an option as that is, to
you must have got a lot of responses. Yeah, like, wow.
Yeah, wow, can't wait.
Thanks.
Yeah, I know, right? Can't quite fly right into Dover, so got to find a way to get from Philly to Dover. And, you know, it's a lot. And like I said, they're doing it on their own dime, on their own time, on their for their own philosophical and ideological reasons, because they truly believe that this is going to open floodgates that are not good. And also, to be clear, there's one part of this revision that happened in the second round where they were, quote, trying to listen to the things that were wrong with the first set of bills. They managed to add the ability for, so generally you're not allowed in the corporate. So all these things that we're talking about, that you can do in stockholder agreements, one thing I should mention is you're actually allowed to do all those things now, as long as you put them in the certificate of incorporation, because that's a public, it's like the constitution, right? So it's like, if you want to do some crazy shit in Delaware, right, you have to change the state constitution to make that crazy shit legal. And that's a higher bar. It's harder to do. It's sort of a public process for the stockholders or the constituents or whatever.
There's like checks and balances exactly. In there. Like, almost, like once you do that, like everybody's right. Kind of agreed
everybody's
to that.
Everybody's kind of aware, and yeah, it's like, it's been through a process.
You got to go, you got to get 2/3 for two right. Straight
exactly.
Sessions.
Exactly.
Two straight sessions. You got to, we're never, you know, we're trying to get the death penalty abolished in Delaware via this. Yeah. Yes, I'm well aware of how these goddamn things work.
Right. So, you know, you can do them in the certificate, but now they want to do them in these side agreements that are not necessarily public. They're not necessarily disclosed. They're also much harder to discover. The certificate is on file with the Secretary of State. You know, it's just, it's a whole different ball game. And so, you know, one of the things that the revisions did is that you are not allowed you're not allowed to basically say you can't litigate an internal affairs or an internal corporate affairs claim outside of Delaware. Like, you can't have a mandatory provision that says some other court has to hear this or it has to go to arbitration. You have to let the Delaware courts litigate the major sort of issues around your company, your internal affairs of your company, if you're going to be a Delaware corporation. That's just kind of like that's the deal, right? Like, you want to be a Delaware corporation? Fine. You have to let the Delaware courts administer justice over whatever things arise. Well, somehow in this revision, they managed to sort of say, notwithstanding Section 115, and do this kind of linguistic trick here, which actually allows these crazy broad, insanely powerful stockholder agreements between one potential stockholder and the entire corporation to bind the corporation to mandatory arbitration, which means that these provisions, okay, the agreements are bad enough, the entry into them is bad enough, but really there are some people who say, don't worry, the courts will sort it out, Laster will figure it out, you know, they'll handle it. Well, the thing is, they won't necessarily be the ones to handle it. And that is bad for all Delaware residents. It's bad for all Delaware legislators. It's bad for everyone who has any interest in Delaware being a continued source of corporate law for the entire country and for the world, which it is. I mean, there's countries, Israel, Taiwan, maybe many countries model their law after Delaware corporate law. If Delaware corporate law ceases to be something that people look to, Delaware becomes less relevant on many levels. And allowing things to go to mandatory arbitration is just kind of like, it's another one of these keystone pieces that's just like a chipping away at the critical piece of the judiciary, which, like I say, seems potentially intentional.
There are two key points here. If you don't like the law, just change the laws. And if you don't like the courts, just get rid of the courts.
Right.
Yeah, go to, I mean, you know, so that settles it all right there.
So as this was an official clandestine meeting, I want to leave, and it was a legal thing, so I want to leave with three footnotes. And I just want to say that these do not reflect the personal beliefs of anybody in this room other than me. Number one. I know you said something about the Department of State, because they run this process, and you're talking about it as a general institution that runs the process. The actual Secretary of State, Jeffrey Bullock, guy's horrible guy.
Oh, he's not a good man.
Not a good guy. No. I wish him very bad things. Now, that's not talking about the thing that runs the thing. The function, you're right. The thing that runs, you're talking about the thing that runs the thing. I'm talking about the guy who's like a Lex Luthor character who, he's not a good guy. So that's the first thing. The second thing that you said, and again, it's fair. Look, we accept all views in here. If the system is something that Israel and Taiwan do, I'm not interested. All of that comes to the third sort of just last footnote for all of this. Yeah, I mean, some people do think that this system is good and it's great, and all these corporations do it, and we like it. And some people don't. I don't. I don't give a shit. Fuck these people. Kind of. Like, I understand it as a product. I understand why it's there. But, you know, if it gets all fucked up and there's controversy and the whole fucking thing collapses, I don't give a shit. Really. So,
I mean, that's the irony of it, is that all of the people who are just sort of like coming into this debate now are like, oh, you know, I like, no one can really decide whether Delaware has historically been shareholder protective or like manager friendly, right? The reality is the Delaware law is incredibly manager friendly. It's friendly. It allows the board of directors. That's a bad thing in certain contexts, right? Connotatively, when you say Delaware is manager friendly, that means sort of at the expense of everyday stockholders, in some sort of ways of talking about these things, the ways that they have like been talked about over the decades. It's so ironic that like we're now getting rid of director centricity, but in a way that is somehow we've managed not to shift any power to stockholders, like normal people, pension funds who should be really concerned about this bill, you know. Not in a way that's actually beneficial to stockholders, where the power used to be divided. Now we've managed to like find one controlling stockholder like Elon Musk or someone like that, who that's the person we're benefiting. Now we're taking power away from the directors and giving it to one random dude. And yes, it's probably a dude. And, you know, it's like this is somehow we have managed to shift power. But again, not in a way that is really democratic.
And all the interviews I did for this, well, let me just say, you know, one of the justifications we hear for this, too, is that, you know, that like, you know, this is actually, you know, by bringing the market practice, the law in line with market practice, that nothing will actually change. And that's the most important thing, right? Because they don't want to kill the golden goose. They want Delaware to be this place where, again, we can collect the incorporation fees and things like that. And one of the most interesting, I can't remember exactly who said it, though, at this point, but one of the most interesting things I heard over the course of these last few months is one of the worst things that could happen to Delaware is for things to go so badly in corporate law that the federal government decides to take it over and it's no longer a state level issue. And I just wonder, you know, is this going to be like the subprime, you know, mortgage crisis where like 10 years down the road, this ends up, you know, basically cascading into just like a rolling series of crisis to where like something like that happens. And then Delaware basically, you know, did it to itself.
Yeah. And you take away enough power from stockholders, shareholder protections, then, you know, you do. There's always been this balance in Delaware of sort of risking federalization. You know, people like Elizabeth Warren would love to federalize corporate law because, and the thing that could absolutely trigger that is Delaware engaging in a race to the bottom. And if this isn't like, you know, race to the bottom is a thing that was a big talking point years ago. It's sort of like this perennial discussion that comes up, but like, this is an insanely huge move that also the idea that we're just going to like, oh, boop, we're going to just align with market practice. We're just going to like bring the law up to what we're doing. Nothing's going to change, right? That completely ignores the reality that Rob was pointing to earlier, which is once you say something is allowed, they will find every way to expand. If these things haven't expanded into some, like, and then the argument's going to be, you said we could do it. You made it very clear.
You said, like, the worst case scenario is X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3. Right. Well, we didn't intend that. And then somebody does X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3, and you're like, well, you said it was fine.
You said it was fine.
Well, I mean,
I relied
what's wrong?
On what you said. You made
said
it the law.
You didn't want it. You weren't. You didn't intend, but it was. Right. It was good. You don't like it, but so we did it anyway.
Yeah,
and that's that.
Yeah, there's no. I mean, federalization is a real concern for Delaware. It always has been, and I don't, you know, there's just a sense of desperation that these amendments be passed to whitewash all of the agreements that are currently out there. Again, I'm not completely unsympathetic to, oh, fuck, we fucked this up. How do we fix it? But I think we have to have a good faith discussion about how we fix it versus just saying, okay, legalize everything. You know, just every, it's just game on. And then not even being willing to take a minute to think, well, maybe we should see, what if the Supreme Court wants to overrule Mullis? Well, that's the proper process here, right? The Supreme Court, you're just completely cutting off the Supreme Court's ability to do its job. The legislature is not meant to do that. There is a very clear sort of separation of powers process argument here that says you should not open the floodgates to every year it being okay for the legislature to be passing laws that overrule cases that are currently in process. Mullis will be appealed. It's not even at final judgment yet. And the Supreme Court is going to be in the, now then the law is going to, like, it's going to, it, the law is not going to impact Mullis, but then likely Mullis will just write some new agreement under the new law. Like, it's going to be a clusterfuck. And, but the point is that you should let the process play minimally. You should let the process play out in the judiciary. And then we can have a long discussion educated among people who actually are now able to be up to speed and understand the concerns. We could write, you know, Vice Chancellor Laster proposed one set of edits to 122.18 that just actually make it comprehensible, I think he said, to a normal literate human being. And, you know, that would be great. Like, I would just love that. Even if you don't make any substantive changes, just make it something we can all read and understand. But, you know, that's apparently too much to ask for.
I mean, obviously we're going to link to Vice Chancellor Laster's posts, because he's been posting through it.
On LinkedIn.
Well,
he's like single-handedly revitalized LinkedIn. Honest to God, like, there are people on LinkedIn now who have not ever. I'm on LinkedIn now, like, posting.
Checking
and I'm
daily.
Like, yeah, so, like, this man.
One of the cool things he's doing is he's doing a sign-off. He's doing sort of a Trumpian sign-off, which is great. So he's doing, like, let's roll, get ready for the future. Godspeed.
Oh, yeah. What was the one? Should I read this?
Enjoy.
Last one?
Yeah, enjoy.
Enjoy.
Yeah.
So history in the making.
So I would like Chance to read whatever one she picks as a good one, and then I'm going to make a suggestion, because I feel like Vice Chancellor Laster might listen to this actually. So I'd like to make a suggestion other than come on the podcast.
Right. So
Vice Chancellor Laster, come on the podcast.
I'm going to tweak the first sentence a little bit.
Okay.
We have almost reached the end of our regular podcast about the market practice amendments. Okay, now this is all VCL. If you continue to think that the amendments are the cat's meow, solve everyone's problems, and are worth discarding board centrism, scrambling the hierarchy of corporate documents, and erasing the border between internal and external, then more posts from me won't convince you. Godspeed.
Yes. So, Vice Chancellor Laster, for your next post, I hope you will do left is best.
Chrissy, I found the pizza, but it's pepperoni. We can go now.